Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, wads? What the fuck, Adelics? Mark Maron here. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome. Welcome to the show. How are you? I will be in Iowa City, Iowa at the Mission Creek Festival, the Englert Theater. On Friday, April 8th, I will be at the Rococo Theater in Lincoln, Nebraska. On Saturday, April 9th, and I will be at the Arvest Bank Theater at the Midland in Kansas City, Missouri. On Sunday, April 10th, those shows will be a mix of some of the new stuff I'm working on and some of the stuff from the More Later special. If you haven't seen that and you live in those places, well, maybe wait till I come to watch it. If you want to watch it, that special is available on Epix On Demand. It's also available now on Hulu and Amazon, my More Later special that I was that I'm very proud of, and I'm glad that people are watching it. And again, I appreciate the feedback on it, because we live in a media world where only a few people can get the things that you do or know that they're out there. So hearing from you is nice. I seem that my life has gotten very small in the last 6 months. It's all working on the show and doing the podcast. I barely watch television. I'm barely abreast of the situation. I know things are going on. I know that there's a charade of a political circus happening. You know, many people try to pressure me to weigh in, to get involved. Well, look, here's my belief. I don't believe America is, I think it's a troubled country, and it's certainly not fair for everybody, but it's not. It is not bad. It is not a bad place to live. There are certainly problems, but this framing of let's make America great again, America's pretty fucking great. And I know a lot of people are in trouble, and there's a lot of problems. There's systemic problems. There's injustice. There's horrible issues with how things are regulated or aren't regulated, and you know who's in charge and what greed does and how people are getting fucked. I'm aware of a lot of those, most of those racial problems. I'm highly aware and abreast of those things that are currents of horror in this country and need to be changed. I have my own ideas about, you know, how to change things, but it doesn't matter. It's not the type of show this is. You know, I deal with sadness, existential anger, the frustrations of just being alive, trying to be a compassionate person and know yourself in the world and try to act from your heart if possible. And I believe in what's left of democracy to some degree. I believe that if everybody out there truly voted their heart, however broken it is and what you do with that heartbreak, that's really up to you and your brain and your conscience. But I think that if everybody went out there and voted what they really believed in their heart, that things could change in the progressive and proper direction for America. Because at some point, America is a great country, but when spectacles like what are happening now are happening, it's fucking embarrassing. It's embarrassing. Sometimes I get embarrassed for our political system, and I get embarrassed about certain parts of our culture and population, and there's some part of me that thinks, hey, maybe it's time for this country to grow the fuck up, you know, and behave like a responsible nation, responsible to each other. People who have beliefs that are unshakable, that's what they're going to do. People who are driven by a selfish and self-destructive fear out of desperation, they're going to do what they're going to do. But I think people with a little sliver of hope and with a certain amount of decency and tolerance, if all of you went out there and voted your heart and what you believed in, I think that change can happen and continue to happen. That's what I believe. That's what I, look, it's no great courage or risk for me to say those kind of things in the general way I'm saying it, but I do think that being part of it, whether you think it's bullshit or not, is important. Be part of it. Go do your civic duty. Look, I can't even avoid jury duty. I'm certainly not going to avoid voting. All right, let's talk about the big events in my life. My cat shit in my pants today. That's what I woke up to. My cat shit in my pants. Did I mention Michael Rappaport is on the show today? I should mention who's on the show. Takes me a long time sometimes. I get rambling. But Michael Rappaport, who I met briefly like many years ago at the Improv. He was not pleasant, very cocky. He was just coming up. And then I ran into him at Sarah Silverman's party like 4 or 5 months ago, and it was great to see him. We talked. I've always liked the guy. He's a straight shooter. He's a real New Yorker. I always find him entertaining. I think he's a good actor, and I was happy to have him here in the garage. So he's coming up. But my cat shit in my pants this morning. How's that happen? No, I wasn't wearing the pants. I know it's it's probably a good setup for a Groucho-style joke. That was brought to my attention on Twitter. But that's what I woke up to. I put my pants in and like 3 or 4 small cat-sized cat turds fell out of my leg. I felt them with the leg going in. I knew exactly what was going on. I looked over at Monkey and I said, are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? You're going to shit in my pants? I've never really received a clearer sort of message that the litter box needed to be changed. He shit in my pants. So that was exciting. What other updates do you need to know? The buzz in the office, the turntable buzz, the panic that I was experiencing. There's a whistle to it, which is really fucking annoying. I had the electrician check the currents at the building, and they checked out fine, whatever that means. But the indicator are, after troubleshooting, that all of these receivers, these two receivers and this one amp, were picking up that frequency on some level, leads me to believe that the building's fucking grounded in a not a good way. And I told the landlord, and she's like, no, I haven't had any complaints. Well, that's because no one's using stereo equipment. And I don't know really what to do with that if the building's fucking grounded wrong. Now, there's still the idea that would... Here's my question to you nerds. And a lot of you guys helped out. You sent a lot of things. A lot of people were... The basic one was like, your turntable needs to be grounded. I'm not a moron. I know that. But the question was my cartridge, which is a sensitive cartridge, it's a Sumiko Blue Point 2, which is unshielded, was picking up the antenna frequency from the roof. That was some of the assumption that I thought. So, like... If there's a person who works in stereo, like for reals in Los Angeles, and you want to email me and maybe, come try to figure this out, because I want to be able to listen to the records you guys send me in my office. You got a better shot at me listening to it if it works there. I don't know if that's incentive. My buddy Langhorne Slim, Sean Skolnick, apparently had some part in designing a hat for Stetson. Because I got this hat in the mail in a beautiful hat box with a card, a little note from Sean saying, look at this, man. I helped design this hat. And it's one of those hats, not a cowboy hat. It's not really a derby, but it's sort of that midway point. It's got sort of a high top, rounded with short sides. So it's a bit of a derby, but it's a little higher with a little bit of a wider brim. It's a unique thing. It's a high-end hat, felt, beautiful black hat. And I don't know how you guys feel about hats, but I've bought a lot of hats in my life, a lot of hats of this sort that were not caps. They weren't baseball hats. I've never been that guy, but fairly dramatic, demanding hats. And I've bought them on my own volition. I've been in stores, hat stores, places that dealt in high-end hats, and I've put them on. I said, yeah, man, I can fucking do this. This is a fucking amazing hat. But... It doesn't ever stick. You wear that hat out of that store with a certain amount of confidence, but not as much confidence as you need to carry that hat. And you start to feel it kind of chip away at you. You start to realize, like, now this hat is drawing not necessarily positive attention. And then you kind of fight with yourself. But I like the hat. There's no reason I can't express myself with this hat. And then you look around, it's like, no one else is wearing hats like this. And the people that are wearing hats like that, you probably made fun of, or you probably think, look kind of stupid, except for that one or two people like Beck and you know, maybe a few retro 70s rock sort of dudes can pull off that hat. And by the time you get home, you're like, oh, well, this, I like this hat. Yeah, maybe I'll wear it. And then it becomes a house hat. So it's a hat you wear around the house. And then it just becomes a hat that you have up in a corner. And you're like, I still like that hat, but I like it on the shelf. I like it hanging on the wall. So I don't know. I don't think I can adjust my entire lifestyle to the hat that Sean sent me, but I do like the hat. And there's part of me that wants to wear the hat out there, but I don't want to be one of those guys where, you know, you can't see past the hat. You know what I mean? I think I'm old enough now to realize that maybe I don't need a hat. It's sort of a red flag in a way at my age. It's a reasonably priced midlife crisis, and you're going to look stupid out there. So I've got a new house hat. And I'm gonna go put it on right after this podcast, the journey of the hat. But it's a nice enough hat that if I hang it on the wall, it'll look good as a wall hat. Got the house hat that will slowly become a wall hat. Right now, I'm gonna talk to Michael Rappaport. It's you know, there's a lot coming at you. Strap in. All right. Before we go to that conversation with Michael, I want to mention that he has a podcast called I Am Rappaport. So go check that out if this rhythm of what you're about to hear resonates with you. Go check out I Am Rappaport, his podcast. Okay. See you on the other side.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Michael Rappaport. I never give anyone an intro. Like, you know, and I, you know, I've known about you and I've seen you around forever. Did I run into you at that party?
Yes.
Sarah Silverman's party.
She got a good party.
It's a good party. I didn't stay the whole run, but it's a nice party.
It's a good party. I see a lot of people there who I only see at that party. So I like it. That's a good party. And it's like a low-key celebrity party. And no one's, you know what I liked about the party? And I told her I was impressed with the party. Nobody was on their phone.
Right.
Which in this day and age is the sign of a good party.
And Senator Al Franken showed up.
Did he? I didn't see him.
Yeah, that was something else. I was like, that's Al Franken. Because now, you know, I've known Al for years and I did Air America with him. But now it's like, that's Senator Franken.
Right, right.
Hanging out with the showbiz types.
Right, right. And then, you know, and of course it's the Sarah Silverman party. Not to say that Senator Franken had anything to do with it because I didn't even see him there.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody was, you know, it's in Los Angeles, openly smoking marijuana and eating stuff and all that stuff. But it's a good party.
New York pizza brought
New York
in
pizza
from
is,
Joe's.
Yep, good good
was
party.
It? Do you know, is there good pizza here?
I think there's good pizza. I think the whole pizza culture in general.
It put some thought into it.
It's changed. It's like, you know, like now, like there's good pizza here. It's different. I think like pizza in New York is no fucking nothing to be so proud about.
There's got to be a couple.
There's good places, but it's not like where it was like, you know, church and state where it was like just good pizza in New York and then like Mulberry Street opened. And now there's all sorts of different kinds of pizzas.
Right.
There's fancy pizzas. There's
wood
vegan
oven.
Pizzas.
Yeah.
Wood oven. Mozza. There's all sorts of shit.
Where do you go in New York? Do you go?
I go to, like, you could get a good pizza at a local place, like a local slice place. So I go to my local slice place, but I go to Patsy's I like.
Yeah.
But I'm not waiting on a line for a slice of pizza.
Right.
I don't give a fuck if God shat it out of his ass. I'm not going for, I'm not waiting on line because there's that whole thing, too. So, but I like Joe's downtown.
Joe's, you mean on 6, Carmine?
On 6, that's always good.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that's the best one.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I don't know if it's the best. I'm sure there's other ones, but I'm not like a pizza scavenger.
Me neither, but there used to be a place on like 48th right off of Broadway there that was really good. I can't remember what the fuck the name of it. They had that grandma slice.
Right. Right.
Which became popular. I like that. And now Two Boots opened downtown, which
I didn't realize. Two Boots is good. Two Boots is good. Cornmeal crust.
I remember when the first one opened on Avenue A, I think.
Yep.
And they put a little one right downtown here. I don't know who goes to it, but it's pretty good.
Two Boots is good. But again, I'm not going all out of my way and all that shit for any kind of food.
Yeah, I won't wait online either.
I'm not waiting online for...
You go to Austin?
No, I've only been to Austin once, and it was just briefly.
Why? It seems
they
like
just,
you should...
They've never had me out there.
Yeah, for any reason? There
for
was
any
no
particular reason.
Reason.
I've never
no
had
reason
any reason.
For, but is, for is Rappaport it, to go to Austin.
Does it live up to all the expectations and hype?
No, but there is... the reason I brought it up is because there's a barbecue place called Franklin's. That's the hipster barbecue place. People wait online 3 fucking hours.
Fuck that shit.
How the fuck can I do
I can kill my own cow barbecue it myself for
in the time that would take you. All right, so let's go back over, because I'm trying to think when I first I knew you were alive. I guess it was around, the Zebrahead movie?
Yeah, Zebrahead was when I first made my enormous splash.
But wait, am I mistaken in that you were a stand-up? Because I remember there's some contention over the fact, who's this guy Michael Rappaport? Is he a fucking stand-up? What's he doing up there? I don't know him as a stand-up.
Right, right. Well, when at the time, there was a little contention. My stand-up career was short-lived.
Uh-huh.
So I came out to Los Angeles in 1989.
From New York.
I was 19. And I started, I never really was I never really considered myself like a stand-up. Like, I didn't understand the whole idea of making an act. I was 19.
Right.
So I would talk a lot of shit, pretty much the same thing I do now.
Right.
But more unstructured shit talking than I'm actually even doing for you right now.
Right.
Because right now I have a beginning, middle, and end to some of my shit talking.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You've honed it.
I've honed my shit talking.
The life story.
Exactly. Yeah. So as far as my stand-up, yeah, I was doing stand-up. But I mean, I would host. I had my 20 minutes and all that stuff. I didn't know that there was contention. But, I felt at that time, with stand-up comedy was it was disco. It was the disco era of stand-up comedy. And there was there was a lot of good stand-ups hanging around, especially the improv, which my stomping grounds was,
But were you affiliated? Were you a relative? Is Claudia your cousin?
Claudia is my sister.
Claudia Lawnow is
my half-sister. Her actual name is Claudia Rappaport. And her stepfather is Mark Lawnow.
Right.
So...
And who owned the improv with Bud Friedman at the time.
Exactly. So I mean, but I did my shit there. You know what I mean? I would go up on open mic and all that stuff. But I was doing my thing, Mark. I wasn't a chump.
Right.
I wasn't Chris Rock or Jay Leno. But when I got up there, motherfuckers laughed.
Yeah, it was real.
And at the end of the day, it's you get up there and either motherfuckers are going to laugh or they're not going to laugh.
But so wait, I don't understand. So wait, so Mark Lawnow is not your stepdad?
Mark Lawnow is my half-sister's stepfather. Oh, so yeah. She remarried. That's why I try to keep the short version. Yeah, so Claudia, and I would come visit my sister, and I would actually come visit her before I even thought about becoming a stand-up comic. When I was 13,
Where are you growing up now?
Manhattan, New York City.
You did?
New York, everything.
And really? What part of New York?
East side of Manhattan.
Really? Yes. So you're a real Manhattan kid?
My whole life.
How old are you?
45. But so I look 27, right?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. So even when you were a kid, when I was younger, so you remember when New York was full of drugs and great and the disco time and you're running around.
Of course.
Did you go to CBGB's when you were 13?
No.
That wasn't your thing, right?
That wasn't my thing. I mean, I started going to hip hop clubs when I was 15.
Oh, there you go.
And it was it was probably more CBGB's than you would think, because it was definitely an underground.
Yeah, no, I never knew about the hip hop thing. Where'd you go?
I would go to Union Square. Latin Quarters had a big hip hop night that was a big thing. Then we started going to a place in Harlem called The Rooftop. These are sort of quintessential hip hop spots before that.
And you'd see live shows?
Live shows.
Do you remember who you saw?
Shit, I saw everybody. I saw Biz Markie. I saw fucking Big Daddy Kane. I saw KRS. I mean, I saw it was emerging. And the clubs that I went to, there was no alcohol served. So
all
any ages.
Cause
I was in there as 15 with grown men, and there was fights, and there was girls with fat asses, and it was a wild thing to see. I was 15 years old, and people would be getting the shit beaten out of them, and music would be playing, and people would get carried out. Girls would get the earrings snatched, and you know, I love the music, and, yeah. and we just went one weekend, and I was like, we just kept going.
So
we just kept
did going. You grow up? What were your parents? Are they in show business?
No, my father was the general manager of a radio station. Speaking of disco, of a radio station in New York called WKTU Disco 92.
Yeah,
was the first station in New York to play disco music
in the '70s.
In the late '70s. Well, in the '70s they played mellow, and then in like 78, 79. He was the one who said we should play disco. They went from the bottom of the charts to the top of the charts.
So your dad was on the cutting edge of all that Danceteria shit, Studio 54, all of it.
They called him Disco Dave.
Oh, my God.
You know, and he was just a Jew from the East Side trying to raise a family.
Is he still around?
Oh, yeah, he's still around.
Did he have his time? Did he party?
He had his time, and he partied more than I think he shares me. But, you know, he was a single dad. You know, I mean, I was with my father most of the time, but my mother and my father divorced when I was young. But he was just a guy, you know, raising his kids, but he had his nights at Studio 54.
Yeah.
You know, he was doing his thing, and he was running the hottest radio station in New York City at the time. So it was a big deal, you know, and it was disco, and it was Studio 54 and cocaine, and I don't know what the fuck he was doing.
Yeah, but it's interesting, though, because if he was running the station, you know, the relationships are sort of, you had access.
Yes.
Sometimes you got free shit.
Yes.
You know, like, I'm sure it's like, well, you want a car? I got a guy, right? Like,
cars, sneakers. Yeah. There was all, the sneakers. Thing was cool because the radio station had some deal with a non-chain sneaker place in New York called On the Run.
Yeah.
And they had a deal with them. So I'd go in there and get free sneakers sometimes. And as a kid, it was like I was like, yo, I could go and get free sneakers and shit.
It's important.
Yeah. So it was cool. And, you know, and because of he worked at the radio station, you know, how I got exposed to, you know, all sorts of music. But hip hop is like in 1979, he brought home a test pressing of the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight. It was a promotional copy.
Right.
And he was like, we're going to start playing this on the radio. It's called rap music.
Yeah.
And that was it for me. Like, I fell in love. I was nine. I fell in love. And it was like, you know, at the time, there was no internet. There was no that. Oh, plus, I was nine. So when I got the record, it was like you lived in the record.
Yeah.
You would play it over and over and over and over. And it was so unusual.
You know all the words?
Of course. I mean, of course, Rapper's Delight. I knew the, and there was a long version. It was a 33-inch. So I knew the long version, and there was a short, but there was like a 15 or 20-minute version of Rapper's Delight. And me and my brother, and then finally he bowed out, and my father was like, turn that shit off. I was like, you brought it home to me, you know? But I just, like, it was like a love affair. Like, I fell in love with that music as a kid, innocently. So.
Yeah. And it was just you and your brother and your father?
Me and my brother, my father, my sister, Claudia, who started this whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
She lived with her mom, and then she was an actress. My sister, she was actually a teenage actress. She started acting early. She got a part. She went to music and art in New York City.
Right. And her mother is an actor, right?
Joanne too.
Yeah, she was an actress.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and she's still alive. But my sister got a part on the TV show Knott's Landing.
Right.
She played Diana on Knott's Landing.
Right.
And that's kind of like how. You
started coming out?
I started coming out visiting my sister, but when I was 13, the what I was telling you about, the improv, I would come visit. I didn't know what anything was, but she would say, let's go to the improv, and I saw everybody perform. I saw Seinfeld, Leno, Keenan Ivory Wayans was the first person I saw on stage. I saw Arsenio. I saw Eddie Murphy. I saw Robin Williams when there would be four people in this. I mean, every single person, and I was just a kid.
Year was that?
Like, this is 83.
So it was all happening. That was the middle of the boom, kind of.
Yeah, and so it was like a unique thing, like Eddie Murphy. I mean, everybody would come to the improv. It was like the spot. It wasn't 15 comedy clubs like they were in Los Angeles.
No, it was it. There was only two.
It was
Comedy Store and the Improv.
And it was like sort of like, you know, church and state. It was like you're either a Comedy Store guy or an improv guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was improv. I was like, in my head, I was like, fuck the Comedy Store. Like, I hang out at the Improv. I'm 13 years old. But, you know, like.
And Claudia's older than you?
Claudia's older than me.
Yeah.
She will tell, for this sake, because she's probably going to listen to this, we'll say she's younger than me.
Okay. But she used to host there too after a while. You know, I don't
know
when.
She used to host there, yeah.
Yeah, she used to do some comedy.
Yeah.
I remember her. I mean, I know her. Mm-hmm. I've hung out with her before.
Did you fuck my sister, Mark?
I did not fuck his sister. Right. I did not fuck his sister.
Okay. But, you know, like it was just an exciting time, and it exposed me. But at the time, I had dreams of being in the NBA. I wanted to be a basketball player.
You're a tall guy.
Tall guy.
Could you play?
You know, in my head, my head was a lot of things going on.
But you never wanted to rap?
Never wanted to rap. I was just a fan. just a fan. Never wanted to rap, never wanted to be an actor, never wanted to be a comedian. Like, I was going to be in the NBA.
At 13, but you liked comedy.
I loved it, you know, but I didn't know what it was, but...
You met Bud and everybody?
I mean...
Of course.
Everybody.
Because I remember, like, after Zebrahead... Like,
that
I,
was 89 now.
Right, but I know. But I just remember walking into the Improv, and you were, like, holding court.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, and also, I had been there. I'd been hanging out there.
Since you were 13.
Since I was... Literally, since I was 13. But in 89, it was like, you know... You fucking...
Not quite, but yeah.
But you weren't around there yet?
No, I wasn't. They never really put me on that much. One time I went on around probably 92 or something.
I was there.
And Mark was there. Yep. And I was a very angry guy at that time, very angry comic, and I did my shit. And it was like, it was uncomfortable. And I walk off and Mark's standing there by the door going out to the hallway. And he looks at me and goes, very uplifting.
And that's saying something coming from him.
He was mocking me.
Right, right, right.
But he's all right.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you're 13 and you're going back and forth.
I'm going back and forth. I'm getting kicked out of New York City public schools and private schools.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Why? You're a criminal?
The only thing that I was disruptive.
Yeah,
I was
sure.
So disruptive that I got kicked out of PS 158, which is a public school in the third grade in the 70s. So you got to be, I think back now, like to get kicked out of a public school in the 1970s, in the, you know, it's in New York City, you got to be such a fucking pain in the ass. There was no fire starting. There was no violence.
Right.
There was no anything. Like, it's just
old school smart ass.
Just an old, like on steroids. Like I was like a fucking pain in the ass. Like, I have no memory of it.
Right.
But I just think back, like, how do you get kicked out of the school in the third grade? Like,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
an accomplishment.
Right,
so,
sure.
So
you put that on your resume.
Exactly. Like, you know, and then it was just, I went to one school to the next school, and then my father tried me a private school, and that was a waste of money. He said,
Where'd you go?
I went to...
Sent you out of state or not?
No, he sent me in school. I went to McBurney. I went to a school called Robert Louis Stevenson, which was like for like, you know, middle class kids. Like it was like basically like a high end place to send your kids that are like on the path to nowhere.
Yeah.
But it was New York and it was the time. But like I just, the one thing that did keep me focused is that I was going to be in the NBA.
Yeah.
So there was no drinking. There was no, I didn't care about girls. I didn't care about anything. I just played ball, stayed out of trouble, talked a lot of shit. I loved...
I like the idea of a school for kids who are on their way to nowhere.
They still have them.
I know.
Like, my, you know, they have private schools where they're like, you know, they're going to get you out of high school.
Right.
And the parents have money, and they're going to pay for you to, like, you know, do whatever the fuck you want. They liberal learning, different ways of learning.
Yeah.
You'll get...
Hopefully, you know, you'll work out somehow.
If you get kicked out of those schools, you're a piece of shit. Like, because they're being paid a lot of money to keep you. So, like, the threshold is high.
Jail's the next step.
Jail or like, you know, rehab or like forest programs, right, or stuff like that, like, you know, wilderness like, shit.
Here's your gear,
right.
Hit the mountain.
Exactly, because if you get kicked out of that shit, and it's always, you know, more privileged kids than not. So,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, my family, you know, so anyway, I wind up getting kicked out of one of those schools. So that was in the eighth grade. In the ninth grade, my father sent me back to Wagner Junior High School, public school. And then 10th grade, I tried to live with my sister. I went to Fairfax.
Oh, out here?
For a year, I was in the 10th. But I just missed New York and missed my friends too much. And then I went to Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn. And if you, that school that year was voted in the Daily News in New York City, the worst public school in New York City.
Yeah.
Which is means a lot.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was like a fucking riot zone.
Did you
literally
get kicked out of there?
They asked me not to come back. They didn't kick me out, but they said, you know.
What the fuck were you doing?
I just was a motherfucker. And then at this point, I thought I was hot shit. I had a bunch of wild, restless, you know, thug friends.
Yeah.
I was the only white kid in the entire school. And this is a rough school. And it wasn't like, well, you must be a tough guy. Like, I just had a lot of friends. And, you know, everybody had their thing. Like, some dudes could fight. Some dudes could play ball. I could talk shit. Like,
yeah.
I could snap.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
I could talk shit. So I could play ball. I was just, you know, I knew how to use my mouth. That was my weapon. Like,
and
if you
never got arrested?
I got arrested once in 1989 for some loitering bullshit. Nothing to be proud of.
Loitering?
Loitering in a mall and, you know, like, and then... It was just some, it was like a quick arrest. It was like, I got arrested because the reason why they
out
actually-
Out here?
In Virginia. It's nothing to be nothing good. And then actually, yeah, but nothing. I got a couple of little small things like that, but nothing like, you know, worth mentioning. Like no stories.
No story behind getting arrested in Virginia.
19 It was literally loitering. And though I think the only reason why they arrested me because I didn't have ID. And I was
what were you doing in Virginia?
Visiting my friends that were quote unquote going to college down here. No. You know, mingling in you know, in small time.
Yeah.
Drug dealing.
Yeah.
Small time.
Yeah.
Doing dumb shit.
Yeah.
Doing dumb shit that Disco Dave's son and June Brody's son shouldn't be doing.
Right.
Doing dumb shit. Yeah. Doing really stupid shit that when I think about this little period of time, I shudder of what could have wind up happening to me.
So you got, did you somehow get scared straight or you just fucking found show business?
You know what? If you see my left ear, Mark?
Yeah.
See my ear?
Yeah.
I got into a fight with like a street fight and with a bunch of dudes that were really about it and got my ear bit off. And if you see like, you know, like the way the shape of my ear.
Yeah.
Like and at this point I knew I wasn't going to the NBA. No college scholarships had come in like I had dreamed really? And practiced for hours and hours.
For the guy who got kicked out of school every year, there was no college scholarship.
No, for the 6'2" Jewish kid from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, for strangely
smart ass big mouth motherfucker
who averaged 11 points, that was his high. No colleges came knocking down my door. I don't know why to this day. I feel like a lot of the Big East schools missed out. But that incident, I called my father. I was like, Dad, I've been in the hospital for the last day. And I got my, you know, I told him. And he was like, you know, listen to me. And he said to me, this is a true story. He said to me, I'm afraid the next time you call me, somebody's going to tell me you got a bullet in you.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't have a great memory, but I distinctly like remember like a shiver going through me. And I was like, that really, like in my head, that
possible.
Could happen.
Right.
And then I actually came back to Los Angeles and got an apartment for $325.
How old were you when the fight happened?
19.
Yeah.
And then I came to Los Angeles.
And you were just hanging out with some bad guys and the shit went down?
Like, I mean, real rough dudes. Like, real rough dudes.
But were those the dudes you were hanging with regular at that time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I was hanging with rough guys.
Yeah.
And I was taken care of and protected. But, like, I was hanging, you know, like, my friends were, like, all from the Brownsville section of Brooklyn, which is the ungentrifiable section of Brooklyn, and Harlem, and they were street dudes. Like, and I, you know, fancied myself a street dude, but I was not, but I was around them.
Yeah.
And it would literally started over some, like, what are you looking at shit? And the next thing you know, we're like in a 4-on-3 street fight, and people are throwing rocks and throwing punches, and I was actually getting the better of this dude, and he bit my ear. And at this point, I had a looming thought that I would be a stand-up comic. And while he was biting my ear, I said to him, "You're biting my fucking ear, I swear to God." And as I pulled away from him, I touched my ear and I couldn't feel it because it went numb. But I, no bullshit, the first thing that popped in my head was, you can't be a stand-up comic with one ear. Like, that's no bullshit. Like, I was like, how am I going to be a stand-up comic?
I thought you were going to say, like, I'm going to get 10 minutes of material.
No. Like, I had never even tried it at this point.
Right.
So then, you know,
I'm going to be the one-ear guy.
I should have went with that. That's why I wasn't a good stand-up. I had
you
things.
You got most of your ear. Did they have to put it back on?
Well, I got a skin graft.
Oh, all right.
So you know, anyway, that kind of woke me up. And
that thing your dad said. Like, if you know it and you feel it, and you know, you know, he says something like that, and you realize, you look at your life and where it is, and it lands, that's terrifying.
And it was great. Luckily, it didn't go any further, because I had no business doing the shit that I was doing. And I was, you know, and I just was... You know, I was young, man. I was so fucking dumb. Like, when you're 19, it's the dumbest part of my life, yet the time that I thought I was the smartest in my life. Like,
course,
now I know how dumb I am.
Yeah.
And I know, like, what my parameters are. But at the time, I thought I knew everything.
Yeah.
And I was untouchable. And I was dumb as shit. And it wasn't tough. And I was just dumb.
Isn't it weird, though? You have kids now?
Two sons, yeah.
You have two sons.
15 and 13.
Really?
Yeah.
Already? When did that happen?
When I was 30. Do the math, Mark. Come on,
I know.
Man.
I'm with you.
I know. It's crazy, though,
but,
right?
But yeah, because, like, I don't know. I don't. You're one of those guys I think I know, but I don't know.
No, you're
from movies.
No, I'm just playing.
But like, you know, when I look back on it, or I even see young people doing comedy now, and they're saying all this shit, and there's part of me that's like, that's not gonna happen.
Right.
Yeah, what are you thinking?
Right.
But you, when you're in it, even if an old guy says to you, like, what the fuck are you doing? You're stupid. You're like, right.
Right.
You know, what do you know?
Exactly.
And now you're an old guy and you're like, nah, yeah.
I know. And now I have teenage sons.
How are they doing?
They're doing good. You know, like they're ahead of me. You know, they're doing well.
In what way?
Terms of where they are in their lives. You know, I mean,
good students and whatnot.
They're good students. They're getting there. I mean, they have the Rappaport name and they're boys. So, you know, there's a sort of a genetic disposition to be a fuck up. But in general, they're good kids and they haven't gotten kicked out of school yet.
Yeah.
So let's just put, they're sweet kids and you know, and they're good. They're good boys.
So you move out here, you get an apartment for $300.
$325.
Yeah,
the 25 changes the game. So if you say 300, it was 325. It's 1989.
So it's okay, 325.
You know, it wasn't 375. I don't think I could have afforded.
Where is that?
It was one of these apartments that's sort of talked about by comics. It was like this. It was on Carlton Way in Hollywood, and a lot of other comics lived there, like J. Anthony Brown.
Yeah,
Jimmy Woodard.
I remember Jimmy Woodard.
Yeah,
happened to that guy?
Jimmy's, I think, still around doing his thing. But it was like the comic place. I started doing my little stand up, and you know, I was able to pay the rent.
And you're 20?
I'm 19.
Yeah, so you're doing mostly at the Improv.
Well, at that point, actually, I didn't start doing stand up. Like, I didn't make any money in for about a year. I mean, we're talking like $25, $50.
Were you working another job?
Yeah, I was a messenger.
Yeah.
A driving messenger.
Yeah.
And which was actually fun because it helped me learn the city because I didn't know I didn't know how to drive.
Had you Thomas Guide. Yeah.
And I would deliver scripts to like actors and agencies. It was a fucking messenger. You'd have like, you know, packages and
did you meet some guys?
I remember that I delivered a script to the guy from Dukes of Hazzard, and he came out, and I was like, "Oh shit, that's a dude from Dukes of Hazzard." But like at the time, like I was like, you know, he came out and got like the package. I think it was a script, but that was like a big deal. Like, yo, that's the dude from Dukes. Not that I gave a fuck about Dukes of Hazzard, but I went to his, and I was like in my head, I was like, "Yo, I know where the guy from Dukes of Hazzard lives."
Right.
The blonde-headed dude, Schneider, I think his name is John Schneider. Maybe I don't know.
Did some singing too. I think that guy.
Yeah. And so I would see people, but I wasn't impressed. You know, like I wasn't, you know, whatever. The job was good, but I kept that messenger job for about a year and a half.
And you had family out here, and you got along with Mark. You could eat at the Improv if
you wanted.
I could
eat at the Improv.
Yeah.
And the cost of living was just so cheap then.
Yeah.
And my apartment is $325.
Right?
It's a fucking shithole. And my mother gave me a used car.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was off and running. And at this point, I was going to be the next Eddie Murphy. In my head, I was going to be Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
That's like what I was going to be. But I had no sort of plan or how to get there. And I was not a great stand-up comedian. Nor did I understand what it takes to become a great stand-up comedian. And then after about year and a half of doing stand-up, I would go on late or real early.
Right.
Like, I was never prime time.
Yeah, of course.
You know, a casting agent saw me doing stand-up, and they were casting the movie Zebrahead, and they were like, yo, you want to come in and audition for this movie? And at the time, like, that's like I was like, Zebrahead was like it was like perfect time. It was the perfect storm. Like it was like the perfect part,
right,
at the perfect time. And when I read the script, I was like, I'm going to get this part. Like,
well,
I
was
knew
sort
in
of
my
like
head,
your life.
It was like my life. It was a softer version of my life.
Yeah.
But like, I related to the whole culture, the music, the sort of outsider aspect of it all, and the interracial. And and at the time, like, I was like, I flew myself to New York. I auditioned, and it was a small movie. You know, it wasn't like a, you know, a big movie, and I auditioned, and I was like, in my head, I was like, there's no way I'm not getting this part.
Well, and you did, right?
And I got the part.
And you added more than the movie. You got sort of noticed.
Yeah. And then I was an actor, and then I was like, I'm not doing stand up anymore. I'm an actor. I quit because, you know. And then I remember like Adam Sandler and, you know, Ben Stiller and Sarah Silverman and Dave Chappelle. I was like, I don't do this shit no more. Fuck stand-up comedy. And I quit. I'm an actor. And you know, I made like $27,000 before taxes. But like, yo, you're 20, 21 years old.
That's big.
That's fucking huge.
And you think you're on your way.
I think I'm on my way.
And you were kind of.
I was kind of. And I bought a Honda Accord. And I was like, yo, this is it. You know, like, and you know, and I, you know, fortunately, I started working.
Like, I know you're still frugal. Like, yeah, I bought an Accord.
Yeah,
I'm a practical guy.
No, I was always good with money.
Yeah.
I was always good with money until I got divorced. But that's a whole other fucking subject.
I know that one.
You know that one, right?
Yeah, I do. too. Yeah.
Yeah.
What, from the mother of your kids?
I'd want to even. I got divorced once, and that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying anything.
It's over though.
There's the kids are still alive, and you know, there's still.
Yeah. You got to deal with it.
There's still bills to be paid.
Yeah, I get you.
Were you divorced?
I was, but I got no kids. I was divorced twice.
Oh
second,
shit!
The second one hurt because I had some money.
Fuck.
It hurts when you get money, but I imagine if you have kids, it's a whole other ballpark.
You know what? I don't understand because you seem like you're a smart dude, and also I need to ask you: was the president sitting right where I'm sitting?
Yeah, right there.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Right where I'm sitting, right he was sitting in here.
Yeah.
When he walked in, was he like, "This is a fucking hovel"? Has he been in a place like this since he's been president?
What he said exactly was a lot of pictures of you around here. Sort of narcissistic, isn't it, Mark? So he took a shot at me right out of the gate.
And were you like, oh, shit, this isn't going well?
No. He was making a joke. I did, and it was very relaxed. You listened to it. It was very relaxed.
I've heard it. Yeah. Were you tripping out?
Yeah, dude. I mean, I had fucking Secret Service all over the place. There was LAPD here. They tented my driveway. We're waiting. We see his helicopters coming over. I mean, he's a fucking president. It's not a casual event. Got five people on headsets out there. It was nuts. Gets out of the motorcade, comes up through that gate right where at the end of this.
The same gate that I walked through.
Right. And I'm standing in front. They told me to wait here for him. He walks in with all these people coming up the driveway, this staff and everything. I didn't even see him. And all of a sudden, out of the crowd, I see Mark. And there's Obama waving at me. And I'm like, Mr. President.
Did chills go through
you? Yes.
Yes. That's crazy. Chills went through me knowing that I was sitting in the same spot.
This is his cup. I put a little glass dome on his cup.
That's
left
fucking
his to-go
cool.
cup.
That's
that was
fucking
insane,
cool.
Dude.
Like, did you sage the place or like? Because I'm not saying any disrespectful way, Mark, but it's got like a lived in smell and not bad, not good.
Well, musky.
It's got a lived in smell. But I mean, this is where all happened.
Yeah, they swept it. You know, they took all.
They swept it in here.
Yeah, they took things that looked dangerous off the desk here, like that hammer and the knife.
Did you ever in all of your podcasting ever imagine that? As good and as revered as you are, and so much of a staple and sort of a, like, you know, like a monumental pillar of podcasting. Yeah. Did you ever even think even that would even be remotely something that could happen? Like,
no.
You'd be interviewing
the president
of the United States? Like,
no. It was crazy. I mean, I had done political talk radio years ago.
Right.
But, like, even then, to get a president, it just never happened. And I never set out to get him. I don't even do politics anymore. And I'm like, what the hell? You know, but I had no idea. And then people are like, well, how are you going to follow that? I don't know. I got Rich Voss on.
Michael Rappaport's coming on.
But what else are you going to do?
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't want to interview candidates. It was an amazing event. I was thrilled that, you know, he thought this would be a good outlet for him to talk to people about himself, which he did. And from everything I've heard, there was not much backlash negative from either side.
Why should there be? It was a great interview.
Well, because there is a bunch of assholes on both sides. They don't shut up.
Right.
And there's always a fucking problem. But a lot of people are like, I forgot how much I liked that guy.
Right.
They're like, yeah, now I know why you voted for him. Why can't he stay there?
Right.
And then there were people that are like, never liked him, but that was great.
Right.
Yeah, so it worked out.
Did you find yourself, like, when you were looking at him, were like, was it surreal? And like, were you like, ever thrown, or like, were you like going through like, did you ever sort of like feel totally relaxed, or were you always sort of like on cloud nine of it? Like, you know, like,
well,
probably right now that you're interviewing me, there's probably a nervous excitement, right? Of course.
Yeah, just like when Obama was here.
That's what I'm saying. So did it ever go away? Like, I feel like you've relaxed into the regular Mark Maron, but with Obama, did it ever go away?
Well, I was pretty open and pretty, you know, kind of vulnerable and nervous, but I also knew that I wanted to do what I do. So, you know, I wore my plaid shirt.
Right.
But I prepared more than I would otherwise because I had a tight hour.
Right.
And there was some things we had to cover, and there was other things I wanted to get to. I wanted to frame it so he didn't get lost in politics or it didn't get too wonky.
Right.
And I wanted him to connect with me.
Right.
So that happened pretty quickly. Like, he disarmed me pretty quickly, made some jokes, and very quickly he's sitting there and I'm like, I see a guy there. There's a guy there.
Right.
And he was connected.
That's
he was
what
attentive.
I felt like I heard. Like, yeah. I felt like I heard the guy.
Yeah. And that happened. So once that started happening,
cool.
I mean, if you listen to it, like 10 minutes in, I'm calling a man and, you know, and I'm finishing his sentences. So there was, you know, there was a comfort there, and, you know, and he's very adaptable in that way. But I really felt like he was present,
right,
and it was a guy. And it was, I, you know, pretty quickly, I stopped thinking about everything that was going on outside.
You were able to zero in.
Right, because I had questions, and I don't usually.
Right.
And I couldn't just fly by the seat of my pants on that one, or else, you know, I risk having an incomplete interview. And I think I covered everything I wanted to cover, really.
Nah, it was good. It was good. Like, so now that you did Obama,
yeah,
interviewed Obama, like, who is, like, the top three people, aside from this, you could check me off,
yeah,
who's the top three people that you would want to get to now?
Well, there's a lot of people, even in show business.
Could pick three, like, if you were like, these would be the three of your favorites.
Yeah. Albert Brooks would be great.
Oh, that would be cool.
Right? You know, there's part, I want to talk to Lily Tomlin about the old days.
Okay.
You know, I think it'd be pretty exciting to talk to, like, Coppola. Right?
Of course.
I don't know, man. There's always people that I talked to Bill Friedkin,
uh-huh,
the other day.
Yep.
And, like, in my mind, like, sometimes, because I've run through my Rolodex.
Right.
So now we get pitch people. And, like, someone like Friedkin, of course I want to fucking talk to
right,
Bill Friedkin.
Right.
Director of the French Connection.
Right.
He was here for 3 fucking hours.
That's crazy.
So, like, if I'm interested, it doesn't matter where they come from.
Right.
Politicians,
right,
I'm not so interested in.
Right, I hear you.
Yeah.
Of course Trump would be fun, right?
I guess, but he would just steamroll me. What are you going to do with that guy? I mean, like, he's going to blow through me. Like, people say that.
Does he blow through, or is he talking bullshit, right?
Well, yeah, he is a
shit talker. I listen to him, and I'm like, I feel like I could be the president.
Right.
If this motherfucker's taking it that far, like, he doesn't know shit. I don't know shit. He just talks some fucking random greasy shit.
Yeah.
And he's just, like, I'm like, yo, I could do this. Like, that's the thing that I think is almost good about him,
yeah,
running.
Yeah.
This motherfucker makes it feel like anybody could be president. Like, this motherfucker doesn't know anything more or less than I do.
Yeah.
He has no, like, I've never heard somebody double talk so well.
Right.
Like, he's just, like, doesn't answer the questions and, like.
Yeah, he works the room.
He works the room and he makes bullshitting attainable.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's good or bad in politics, but I'm like, I'm going to run for something. Like, well, I seriously feel like I could be the mayor of New York.
Yeah.
If this fucking guy could run for president, I could at least be the mayor of New York.
Schwarzenegger was the fucking governor of California. Reagan was the fucking president. I mean, you know, actors have done, you know what I mean? It's possible.
It's possible.
But yeah, no, but I don't know what I'd do with him. Because, like, there's, like, here's the problem, and even with Obama, but not so much when I talk to him, is that they have an agenda. And if they have an agenda, right, everybody sort of has an agenda.
Right.
So, like, you know, that agenda, like you said, the ability to deflect questions and deflect conversation to sort of service what you want to talk about anyways is annoying.
Mm.
So, you know, like, I knew, like, with Obama, they didn't tell me, they didn't give us questions. They gave us final edit. They knew he's a pro.
Right.
So, like, anything that
right,
guy.
You're not going to trip up Obama.
That's right. So anything they don't want to answer, they're just going to be like, well, that's a good question. I'm going to talk about something else.
They're going to take you down a fucking lake.
Yeah, that's right.
You're going
to
be down a lake. That's and it. By the time you realize you're at that lake, yeah, you're going to be, like, too far to hike
yeah
up. You're going to be all, and, like, and you're going to be on a pond somewhere.
Right. Yeah. So I don't really want to deal with the camping. What were you saying, though? We were talking about divorce. You said, I'm a smart guy. I've been married twice.
Oh, I don't know. We were talking about divorce, child
but yeah,
support.
But yeah, I told you.
No, the reason why I was going to ask you, Coach, so you don't have kids, because child support.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say or not say whether I deal with this, but
yeah,
just in general.
Yeah.
And you would think, what does a random person bringing up child support? He's probably dealing with it, but I'm not going to say either
right
way. But child support, I just want to throw this out there. See, but you don't know this, but I figured you were probably smarter than me, is a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Because with child support, you get forced to pay a certain amount of money each month. And there's no proof of receipt
uh-huh
on where that fucking money is going.
Right.
And I thought, because I like your point of views on things, if you had experienced that, you could really break that down.
Yeah.
Because it's a motherfucker. And as far as, like, I don't know if it's state by state or a national thing, but, like, I feel like the Second Amendment and the child support laws don't change. Those are the only fucking two things that change. iPods improve, cars improve, but those motherfucking things, child support.
So, your issue is.
And this has nothing to do with me. It's a cousin, a friend
okay
of mine.
All right, so your friend, I think the issue he's dealing with is the basic sort of, like, what's she doing with the fucking money?
Why is there no proof of purchase? Where's that fucking money go? Again, this has nothing to do with me.
I understand. But
I just heard a guy talking in a coffee shop down the street.
I know. I'm with you on that, and I feel bad for that guy.
Yeah, me too. I don't even know his name.
But the truth of the matter is like, I guess you could ask the kid, where's the new shoes that your mother said that she got?
Right, your pants look too small, and you look thin. You don't seem like you're eating good.
I don't understand. I sent her money.
Where's the fucking money going?
I understand.
And why don't you have like a 7-foot Christmas tree? You got that bullshit Christmas tree.
And why is she driving a new car?
Yeah. I mean, and then not my kid.
Not me, the other kid. The guy at the coffee shop.
Yeah. Right.
No, I know. Like I guess I dodged that bullet. But all of that shit. As soon as lawyers are involved, it's a no-win game for anybody.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
And those no good fucking judges. Yeah. They truly do judge you.
Yeah.
They judge you.
It's their job.
Yeah, I know. But until you're actually judged by a real judge.
Yeah.
You've never been judged. Like it's still like you can be like, well, that girl judged me. My boss judged me.
Yeah.
No, until you're in there with that no good judge, and he's really and he's seen it all.
Yeah, all of it.
Like, there's not like all your fucking like rhetoric,
all your bullshit.
It means nothing
to this
guy.
Can't shit talk a judge.
A judge?
Because they're like, all right, that's fine, but let's talk about the issue at hand.
And he's gonna do it in 3 to 5 seconds, and you're not gonna know what the fuck happened to you until you're at the fucking bank pulling out money. And you might as well just be in Vegas just gambling it away because it's going nowhere.
Yeah, to the lawyer. Yeah, there's more paperwork.
Fucking no good lawyers,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I know. You know what got me is the disclosure process.
Right.
That killed me. Like, I was like, I don't have kids, but I'm like, I'm right. I have a just fucking fight here. And then they have you do, we need all of your phone bills for 20 years. Whatever the fuck it is, I've never been more organized in my life. I was at Kinko's 3 hours a day putting shit together for her dumb lawyer, not realizing that it's a fucking shakedown.
It's a fucking shakedown. And then you're at Kinko's for 3 hours, yet your court session's like 36 seconds.
You don't even go. You get a piece of paper that says, that it was filed for $2,000.
It's motherfucker. Oh, you mean the lawyer bills?
Yeah.
That's a fucking, see, that's what I don't understand. Those motherfucking lawyers.
Yeah.
Those divorce, that's a show.
On both sides.
They're fucking scumbags. The more you argue, the happier they are.
Exactly. They just want to keep going.
Yeah, and your lawyer is acting like your therapist, but he's really just going ka-ching.
Yeah.
Ka-ching.
Oh, sure. And I guess we can try that. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah,
so you
no, fuck
keep
her.
Going?
I don't like her. And then, what do you think of her lawyer? And he's, we're going to game plan. It's like he thinks he's fucking Bill Belichick and it's the Super Bowl. No, right. It's just a fucking racket.
Then after that, they go home and they call the other lawyer, like, how you doing? I'm good.
They're probably fucking each other, the two lawyers.
Somehow. Shake that. But that's the operative word for me with all that stuff, is that it really does become a shakedown. And the only way it ends is when the guy with the money goes, all right, I'm done.
I've had enough. I submit. You put me in the figure four. I got it. You win. I can't take it anymore.
Exactly. And then all that money you spent being righteous, it's like, why the fuck? Because any motherfucker, I'll tell you this right now, any guy who's been through it before will tell you right to your face, pay her. Just give her what the fuck she wants.
Off the top.
Just pay her.
Because when those, what is it, ESQs? What's the thing for a lawyer?
Esquires.
When they get involved, that's when the fucking party's over.
Yeah.
And you think, and then you think you're like in some sort of fight, but it ain't the Thriller in Manila.
No.
it ain't Pacquiao versus Mayweather.
No, it ain't Rousey versus the other girl.
No. It's a fucking slaughter.
It's fixed, and the guy with the money's gonna lose.
Yeah, Don King's coming in for the fucking fix.
Yeah.
So anyway.
You're all right, though.
I'm all right.
And
I can't complain.
Right.
The kids are good.
Good. So, all right. So now, going back to your story. So Zebrahead, so you're launched.
I'm launched.
You got an agent, big agency.
I got a manager.
You're going out. Well, I don't think people realize. I don't think I realized until I looked at the filmography. I mean, you've been in like a fucking 100 movies.
Yeah, I mean.
One way or the other.
Yeah. Good, bad, and indifferent. But yeah, I've worked nonstop since 1991, man. And I've had the fortune of doing a lot of, great movies with a lot of great people and work with a lot of great directors. And, and I've learned a tremendous amount.
Like your fifth movie you did was True Romance.
That was
which is
big.
Everyone loves that movie. I watched it recently. I got it on Blu-ray.
You're really great
in that movie.
Thank you. It's a good movie.
It's a sweet part.
It's a sweet part. That's really who I was at the time. Like, yeah. I was like an actor who wanted a break. And that's why I got the part, because they were casting that film. And it was actually, that was at the time when scripts were scripts. They weren't sent. They weren't emailed.
Yeah.
So you'd get them. And the word around town was big about the True Romance script for the actors and Quentin Tarantino had just done Reservoir Dogs,
yeah.
And then around this time, Natural Born Killers had come out,
yeah,
which
so he's
he wrote.
Hot. Yeah.
He's hot, and it's exciting. And so this True Romance script that he's directing is being passed around, and like, you know, all my actor friends were auditioning for one part or another, and we started hearing, oh, well, Christopher Walken's going to play the mobster. Oh, shit, the mobster. And they're like, well, Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette, who had just come off a really good part in The Indian Runner,
yeah.
They're going to play. Oh, that's cool. And then Dennis Hopper's going to play. Oh, shit, so Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken are going to be doing that scene. Yeah, that fucking 8-page scene. And so there was just this anticipation. And I had auditioned for a mobster part.
Yeah.
And
Gandolfini's part?
No, just a small part.
Yeah.
A small part. I'll actually say which part it was, because I never like to sort of discredit. But it was a part that my friend and actor friend Kevin Corrigan.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that he wound up playing. So I had auditioned for that part, and I was in the loop for that. And I was like, you know, like...
I interviewed him.
He's a good dude.
Yeah, great guy.
And me and Kevin have worked with each other a lot. Like, he was in my first movie, Zebrahead, and Kevin had already done... He'd done Goodfellas. He had done Men Don't Leave. And I was like, yo, that's Kevin. You know, like,
yeah,
I knew
yeah,
who
knew
he
him.
Was.
Yeah.
And he just, like, working on a film with Kevin...
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of like the first time when Zebrahead was the first actor I saw act the way I wanted to act.
Yeah.
Like he exploded. He had a small part in Zebrahead, but he exploded at me, you know, when cameras were rolling. And I was like, yo, this guy's like Al Pacino.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to do that. And then we had pizza and like, you know, we became friends and the rest is, you know, friendship history. But the casting director, who was Mary Verneuil, she was the casting assistant, while they were trying to cast Dick Ritchie.
Yeah.
She told my agent, yo, you that guy, Michael Rappaport guy, should come in and read. Like, he's like that. So I went in and read on a Saturday with the great Tony Scott. And I remember behind me was all the photos of who the people were going to be in the movie.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, like I'm looking up there and they were like Xerox copies of Christian Slater, Patricia Arquette, Val Kilmer,
yeah.
Samuel Jackson, James Gandolfini, who was nobody at the time.
Yeah.
And so on and so on. And I'm like, and I told Tony Scott, who passed away, I said, please don't let me leave here until I get this part.
Yeah.
And he said, all right, mate, you know, we'll try. And I just read and read and read. But like, I think just like that earnestness was really... made sense.
Well, you probably had to peel back. It's a pretty vulnerable part.
Yeah, it's who I was.
Sweet
kid who just wanted his big break. And,
right.
You know,
and you're so naturally filled with bluster. I imagine Tony was like, all right, turn it down.
Yeah.
Tone it down a little.
Well, at the time, you know, I don't know what the fuck was going through my head, but I knew like somehow like this was for me.
Yeah.
And there's been certain moments in my career, like Zebrahead was the first one. And True Romance was the second one. I was like, this is for me. This
yeah.
is my part.
Right.
And I got it. And doing that film was like, you know, I would show up on set when I wasn't in the movie because you
yeah,
know.
Yeah,
like,
you got
like,
it.
Like I was on set when they did the Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper scene. And
right.
James Gandolfini. He was just a guy like me. We were like, I can't fucking believe this. And Gary Oldman was like, I remember being in the makeup trailer and Gary Oldman was over there doing like a hair test because he was, and I was like, what the fuck? They were actually considering me for that part at one point.
Wow, that's a big part. That's a heavy part,
yeah,
right?
So it was just a privilege to be in it. And Tony Scott was so welcoming with all my thoughts and ideas, and I was going to be Marlon Brando, and I have these ideas, and I'm going to create. And some of the things he would say, no, no, no. And some of the things he would say, yeah, 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 try it. But he never told me to shut the fuck up.
Right, and then, but before that, Poetic Justice, that was a pretty big movie,
mm-hmm.
right? Was that Janet Jackson?
Tupac.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just had a little part in it, but I wanted to be in it because I loved Tupac, and I knew how special he was, like a lot of other people. Like, you knew you were... around somebody who was special. And yeah. then, like, I was at... just to go to the cast reading and the rap party, like, fucking Janet Jackson was there. And this is when Janet Jackson was, like, Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
And Tupac was there, and Regina King, who...
These are your heroes.
I'm like, yo, and John Singleton, who had just done Boys in the Hood. I'm like, yo,
great.
This is... You know, I'm 25 years old, so I went... I remember just, like, I don't care how big the part is. It was with Tupac. I went to the fucking cast read through and I went to the rap party. And I remember the rap party like it was, like Janet Jackson was like, oh, I saw True Romance. I love that. And I was like, this is fucking crazy here.
Yeah.
This is crazy. And Tupac, and I got a Polaroid with Tupac.
You still got it?
I still got it.
That's sweet, man.
Yeah, so
Singleton's great. I think that, that movie Baby Boy,
yeah,
a fucking masterpiece.
Me too.
I love that fucking
movie.
Really
Boys
in the Hood's good too, yeah.
He's but, discovered so many great actors.
Yeah, I love his work. I'd like to talk. He's another guy. See, we bring it up. I'd like to talk to that guy.
I can connect you with him. He's a good dude, easy, good yeah. dude, like low key, loves movies, loves talking, loves actors, loves film.
Oh, wow.
And just a good the same dude he's always been. Like a good dude.
Oh, well,
really smart. He's like a fucking encyclopedia. He's like one of these encyclopedias.
Film nerd?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a nerd. I'll tell him this to his face. I love John. He's a nerd who's also a film nerd.
Oh, I'd love to fucking talk to that guy.
He's good people.
All right, so you do that. So you do True Romance. And there's a lot of movies here that I haven't seen.
Some of them aren't that good, Mark. Some of them aren't worth seeing. Some of them might be good, but listen, you don't never know.
You'll take the gig.
I'll take the fucking gig, and you go into it thinking everything's going to be Gone with the Wind. They ain't Gone with the Wind. Kiss Toledo Goodbye up there.
Yeah.
That's one of the things you've never seen. Don't fucking see it. It's a piece of shit. Great cast, but it was with Christine Taylor, Christopher Walken, a lot of piece of shit. You never know.
But you're one of those guys that's going to represent himself no matter what. There's a baseline to your personality that's not going to go away. You're not going to disappear. So anything you're in, you're like, that's Michael Rapaport doing some variation of that guy.
When you're just an actor.
Character actor, right?
Yeah, but when you're just an actor, yeah. you're solely responsible. And you could drive yourself crazy. And this is where I think actors get a bad rap. Because especially the more and more successful you get and the more pressure. But when you're just an actor, like the only thing you can control is your performance. And that even that, at the end of the day, a director and editor have the final say
right,
in it.
Right, right.
But I could see like why stars, you hear about like stars fighting with studios or stars fighting with directors.
Yeah.
Like, your fucking ass is on the line, and your pedigree and your ability to continue to star in movies is on the line. And the business of show business, I could see how Brando was the most famous for sort of despising it yeah. outwardly and openly first.
Right.
How it could drive you fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Because you become a commodity and then you can't even control what you're doing. So, but for me, I go into, especially when I was young, everything was like just earnest, I was like Kiss Toledo Goodbye, that piece of shit, amongst other things, and we went into it thinking it's going to be this great mobster comedy, and it didn't turn out that way. But at the time, you don't know.
But you were in like Higher Learning, that was a big movie.
Yep.
And Basketball Diaries, that was a good movie.
Basketball Diaries,
working with Leonardo, right?
A little DiCaprio. He went on to bigger and better things and greener.
He did all right.
He did all right for himself. The funny thing about Higher Learning is that he was actually going to be in Higher Learning. The original cast for Higher Learning was Leonardo DiCaprio, Tupac,
yeah.
and Gwyneth Paltrow. And I was going to play a different part. And then for some fucking strange reason, DiCaprio decided to do some movie about a sinking ship. I don't know what the fuck he was thinking. I don't know what came of that thing.
What a mistake that was.
It was some fucking piece of shit he That's wanted to crazy. Do about a ship and James Cameron. And
some guys just make the wrong choices.
I don't know what the fuck he was thinking about, Mark. But anyway, Basketball Diaries.
And then you work with Woody?
Woody Allen. That was a big deal.
Yeah, of course it was a big deal. It was a big movie, Oscar winner with what's
Mira
her name?
Serino, Mighty Aphrodite.
Yeah.
And that was big for me. It was exciting.
Most of the people I talk to that work with him, he's pretty low key, right? He kind of counts on you to do what you do.
He doesn't count on you to do what you do. You know what he wants?
Yeah.
The first thing he wants is he doesn't want to talk about him being Woody Allen. That's number one.
Yeah.
Like, say, he doesn't want any sort of fanboy shit about like, what was it like when you did Manhattan? He doesn't want to talk about himself. But, I got him to talk very open and sort of regularly about basketball.
Yeah.
Fast food in New York, Chinese restaurants, and jazz music. Because I knew going into it, don't talk to him about any, don't ask
his
him.
Movies.
He doesn't want to talk about that. But if you talk to him just regular and you're not like, extra giddy with him, he'll talk to you. but like as far as his process, like he writes a script, it's actor proof. The way he shoots things is very contained. He doesn't do a lot of coverage. Everything looks beautiful. He doesn't rehearse anything. So, like, we would have, like, 5, 6, 7-page scenes, and he would be like, let's just shoot it and see what happens. And, like, I'm talking about, like, you don't run the lines.
Yeah.
Like, he would kind of, like, do this part over here, do this part over here, walk there, walk back, and then we'll see what happens. And a lot of times it just works.
Yeah.
And, And but there's definitely a method to the madness,
yeah,
and a method to the magic.
Yeah.
But he just sort of scales down all the bullshit.
Right.
And at the time, I was like, you know, what the fuck?
He's got complete control, and he's
complete
not
control.
Yeah, and that makes a big difference.
Great people, you know, in the film, the writing. Anyone can do a good performance in, yeah, a Woody Allen film.
Right.
The writing itself is so good.
Yeah, no, there's been quite a few good ones. And then, like, Copland, well, that was the next. That should have been a huge movie. I kind of like it. It's a weird-ass movie.
It's a, yeah, good movie.
Did you get to work? Did you get to talk to Sly and everybody?
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them. And I was, like, a fucking kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
Like, I was...
Leota.
Ray Liotta, De Niro.
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone. And, like, Sylvester Stallone, you know, like... Like, Rocky was the first movie I ever saw that moved me.
Yeah.
I was six when I saw it.
Yeah.
But somehow it got me on an emotional level. And then De Niro and then Harvey Keitel. And but to be on a set.
New York guys.
I couldn't fucking believe that. Like, I couldn't believe.
Is Sly from New York or Philly?
Philly.
Philly, yeah.
But,
close.
You know, he was like a fixture in my life. And yeah. De Niro was a fixture in my life. And the first day on the set of Copland, like, I'm on the set with Sylvester Stallone, Ray Liotta, Harvey Keitel, and fucking Robert De Niro in a movie. We're shooting downtown by One Police Plaza, and I'm just like floating.
Yeah.
Floating through air. Like, I can't believe that I've done this.
Yeah.
And you know, and I knew to keep my fan shit, you know, in this is before yeah. cell phones and all this stuff.
Right.
But like I remember like, you know, writing in my journal, like,
right.
you know, in the thing, like, I can't believe I'm going on set. I'm about to do this scene with De Niro and Stallone. And it was just a great experience. And James Mangold directed it. And, you know, the film turned out good. And there was so much excitement and hype on it because it was going to be Sylvester Stallone's return. And I'm going to gain weight and all that stuff. And, you know, I mean, it was fun. Peter Berg was in it.
I know Berg.
Yeah. So I
lived with him briefly.
Did you really?
In Culver City when he was starting out. I was starting out.
That's
Steve
funny.
Brill. Me,
okay.
Steve Brill.
Oh, shit.
And Berg. Briefly live with each other.
That's crazy.
And they pushed me out.
They got rid of you.
Yeah,
that's a crazy bunch right there.
Yeah, yeah. And we were kids. But so did you talk to De Niro? Were you able to sort of get a little?
You know, we had a little exchanges. I knew better than to fucking, again, like, I just, like, I don't have Tourette's, but I felt like I had a Raging Bull Tourette's.
Yeah.
Like, I was just going to be like, Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Taxi Driver. Travis Bickle. Casino. Like, but I kept it under control. You know, we had funny exchanges. He was very polite, very, like, I treated him like a professional. He treated me like a professional.
Right.
So when I was in front of him, I knew the best thing to do was to just bring it to him. Just be a pro and be as good as I could possibly be. Stallone was a different story. Like, I was with Stallone, like, Rocky 1 through 6.
Yeah.
Every single line from every single movie, right. I would do Paulie lines.
Yeah.
He would do Rocky lines. I would do Rocky lines. He would do Adrian lines. I would do his lines. He would do other people's lines. Like, he loved it.
Yeah.
He answered every single one of my Rocky fantasy questions.
Yeah.
Burgess Meredith questions. My Carl Weathers questions, my Stallone, every single fucking question.
Yeah.
To the point where James Mangold was like, do not talk to him. Don't fucking speak to him. This is Copland. This isn't Rocky III. He's not talking about Clubber Lang. Don't talk to him on the set unless it's within the character. So he was cool and very generous and totally, like, you know, appreciated it and never, like, annoyed, and, like, he was cool.
Did you become friends?
You know, until the last day, and I haven't seen him since. I saw him at a basketball game 2 years later, and he looked at me like I was an usher. But he's, you know, and I get that now.
Did you see the new one?
Loved it.
I got to see it.
For Sylvester Stallone to get nominated for Best Supporting Actor for essentially Rocky VII,
yeah.
It's almost like, you know, like, it's a Rocky story within Rocky VII.
Yeah.
But he deserves it, and he was great in Creed. I loved Creed, and I was as cynical as anybody going into it. I had fucking tears coming down my face.
Sure.
It's great. Creed's great, and Michael B. Jordan is great. And the thing about Creed that it does is that it serves... it creates a new movie,
yeah.
for all of us. It refers to the old stuff, and you get the old Rocky magic.
And also for your kids.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, then let's get Bamboozled. That you were great in that. That's
Thank
a great
you.
Movie.
Spike Lee.
I love that movie.
It's a good movie.
You know why I love that movie? Because, I mean, he shot it on digital, I think.
One of the first movies on digital.
Yeah, and I know there's, but the way they produced the minstrel show
yes.
as television.
Yes.
And they showed it. With those colors in it, it was disturbing
yes.
and beautiful. Like, you know, that's what it would look like. And how different is that?
Yo.
From, like, it was powerful to me.
Yes.
Just specifically the way they shot those minstrel shows.
Yep.
It was fucking devastating.
Yeah. No, it was very, very...
Was that hard for you to do, to go against character a little bit?
Because
you were kind of the asshole, the insensitive sort of...
Like, nah, I loved it. You know, like, as an actor, like, you love that shit. Like,
and,
you,
and Spike was good to work
Spike
with?
Spike is very similar to Woody. Like, he's very much like, he loves the actor to do his thing.
Yeah.
Very sort of, you know, he empowering and lets you do your thing. And because it was one of the first films on digital, I mean, I'm talking about digital, like, it was small little cameras around
the
room.
Yeah,
yeah. We had cameras, like, we would do fucking 10-page scenes. There were long scenes, and we'd be done like that because there was. I was like, "Did you get the coverage?" He was like, "Yeah, there's a camera there," and I was like, "Oh shit!" You know, it was like there
hidden
was
camera
surveillance cameras almost. And if you watch the film again, and it definitely deserves a second watching or a first watching, you'll see that like the way it was shot was very unique and exciting cast and a Spike Lee movie in New York and. Yeah. You know, I'm proud of that movie. You know, it's
and
a
then
cool
you
movie.
Didn't. You, I didn't realize. You, I didn't realize till now because I'm. This is how I do it. But
it's
you
fine.
Did. You did two with. You did two with Woody.
Two.
Yeah, that's
small
fucking. That doesn't
crooks.
Happen all the time.
No, I know. I got invited back. Now I'm concerned that I didn't get invited back for the third time. I'm like, did I fuck up? Did I step on his toes? But no, I'm sure I'll get a chance.
What? But there's so fucking many movies. What other ones that other than the ones we talked about here really made a mark on you and who you work with and what happened?
I mean, Beautiful Girls is a movie people talk to me about. That's a good movie.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I directed a couple of docs recently. I directed a doc called Beats, Rhymes, and Life about the group A Tribe Called Quest.
Oh, that's
Quest.
Right. That's pretty recent, right?
Yeah, and that was a big thing for me to do and to pull off. And you know, you got the Gimme Shelter poster.
Yeah, yeah.
There. That's a film that I reference a lot making that film because Gimme Shelter to me is perfection.
Oh, yeah. It's the greatest.
Yeah, and I love that poster. But, you know, that was a big deal because I had always wanted to direct something. And, you know, I just kind of fell into doing the Tribe movie and, you know, the success from that was cool. And, you know, just everything it took and the challenge of it and the frustration of it and the work of it. But, you know, it won awards. It's fucking certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, which, you know, you're like, yo, we're certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
That means something.
And you know, so it's, you know, it's been a bunch of shit. And, you know, and I've been fortunate, you know, to do what I do, you know, and you know, and do good TV shit, and do, you know, direct shit, and now the you know, I started doing, you know, I got to tell you, you're one of my inspirations for doing my podcast, yeah. The I Am Rappaport podcast.
How often you do it?
Twice a week.
Oh yeah, you got the model.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, and you know, and like just even like you know the because I was gonna call it the motherfucking I Am Rappaport podcast,
right?
But you know, I didn't think that would be sellable.
No.
Not that even the IRM.
Even WTF is a little bit of an obstacle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, like, I just, you know, like, being with you and doing this show with you means a lot to me because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, you know this, you know, podcasts are becoming so part of the culture now.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've been doing this shit for so long. But what I wanted to ask you is what made you start doing it when nobody was doing it?
Desperation.
Like, what do you mean?
My stand-up career was not happening. Yeah, you know, my acting career wasn't happening. You know, the radio thing was over, and I didn't know what the fuck I was going to do.
Right.
And that's really what happened. All we committed to was two episodes a week, no matter what, new episodes. We drop them like clockwork and see what happens. At the beginning, it wasn't even an interview show. It was sort of a mishmash of things. The idea of WTF was really about a theme that we were going to have segments and stuff. And then it just sort of, once I moved out here, I set up in here. We were doing a third act occasionally. That was a comedy piece. And then that just started to go away and it became what it became.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah. It was just persistence and sticking with it. And there was no way to make money at it for a couple of years. And,
right.
And then all of a sudden it was just good cosmic timing for once in my life. You know, I had a certain skill set that I didn't think I had.
Right.
You know, I would never have thought that I'd be thought of as this interviewer or a good interviewer.
Right.
I still don't like the word interview. I like to have conversations.
Right.
And it just sort of grew. I happened to be there at the, you know, at the first wave of popularity of this thing.
Right. Well, that's cool, man.
And define my little nook of it.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm happy that other people do it. I'm happy I helped define the medium for some people or gave some people hope that they can succeed at it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like anything else. There's a lot of them out there now. And
yeah.
See what happens.
Yeah, well, it's I mean, it's a good time. And honestly, you know, like with all the bullshitting and shit talking and all that stuff that we're doing. Like, I really respect, you know, like what you've done, and I'm sure other people feel like you've inspired them, because you definitely inspire me, because you do make it a conversation, and you do it in layman's terms, which is something that I could definitely respond to, because when it gets too highfalutin, I'm like...
But it's also a personality-driven thing, and you've got that in spades, for fuck's sake, you know, so what's the angle of yours?
You know, I just talk shit. You know, we talk about, you know... You
have guests, you have a sidekick. What's
guests,
the structure?
My sidekick is actually my best friend. I call him the Black Ed McMahon, but his name is Gerald Moody.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been my best friend. We've been friends since like 1982. And at first it was just me. And then I was like, yo, I'm doing this podcast. Like, come when I'm recording one day. This was early when we were doing it. We've only been doing it a year.
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, well, I'm going to ask you some things and you just do what you do. And he was totally comfortable. And then I was like, yo, you got to do it with me. But we talk shit. We have fun. You know, we do the Sick Fuck of the Week, which is an award that is earned, not given. So you can't just be a sick fuck. You got to be a special kind of sick fuck.
Yeah.
One of the segments that people like a lot is Famous White People with No Lips, which is again, and then Charlie Sheen actually inspired me to give, he was a double winner because he was the first person to win the Sick Fuck of the Week and a Famous White Person with No Lips. So like, I like to have fun, talk about music, sports, and just in general. I like interviewing, but only if it's somebody that I really, you know, I'm curious and excited about.
Yeah, yeah. So you mix it up. You
got I mix it up.
Comedy segments and some themes.
Exactly, exactly.
And how's it going?
It's going good, man.
People coming around?
People are coming around and it's fun. And, you know, for me, it's fun and at times it's challenging because, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, shit, I got to record. And,
well, yeah.
But not like challenging, like I got to go like build a house with like,
no,
you know,
but you still got to show up for it and you don't want to, you know, autopilot something that you're in charge of.
Exactly. Because, you know, that's the thing that I like about it. It's like, you know, you can't, I can't. Although I'll find a way to complain about anything,
because
that's what I do. Like, I'll complain about the podcast that I'm doing that I have total control over, because that's just what Jews do. We just tend to do that, especially abrasive, big mouth, you know, Jews.
I got my own version of that.
Exactly. So, but I just love doing it, and you know, and you know, people have loved doing it, and you know, we're carving out our little niche, and I try to keep it honest. We don't fact check anything.
Yeah,
that's one of the things I pride myself.
That'll get listeners excited.
Oh yeah, well, it's the only non fact checking.
Oh yeah,
podcast.
Get a lot of emails that way.
A lot of emails that way, and there's really no accountability because it's a non fact checking podcast.
Sure, and then people are just like, "You fucking idiot!"
Right,
and then you get to read that on the air.
Exactly, exactly. And I didn't know that to begin with, but I was like, you know, I didn't want to do it in front of a computer, because when you first do a podcast, like, you were probably like, you're just like, you're talking into a mic, alone,
which is like
a crazy person.
Hard to master that. Well, it's an amazing skill is what it is. I mean, if you think about radio broadcasters who do that for hours, I mean, it's like, it's a fucking skill. And once you learn how to do that, I remember the moment where I'm like, I can own a mic on my own for a couple hours if I have to.
Right, if you have to.
Right, on radio.
Right.
And that day was sort of like, all right, it's like an amazing skill set to have.
It's liberating.
It is.
It's liberating. So that's one of the things when I say fun and challenging, like finding that within me and you know, and trying to just make your point of view honest and genuine without being TMI, without telling too much.
I don't mind too much.
I mean, but you could be like
style.
Too much.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like too much.
Well, you don't want to be sad.
You don't want to be sad, pathetic, or, you know, like you just don't want it. Like, you have to find, like, you know, what the parameters are. Like, I'm being 100% honest, but not 150%
I don't
want
to drag you into my shit, so I'm going to stop there.
Right, but I want to drag you in, but not totally drag you in it with me. Like, I want you to feel my pain, but don't, you know, I don't want you to live it. So, you know, so, like, just kind of, so I love doing it. And you know, in between things, you know, it's a fun thing. I enjoy doing it, and it's exciting.
Well,
and,
good, man. Yeah, well, congratulations on that. Are you doing any movies right now?
I just finished a movie with Liev Schreiber. I feel like the title might change, but it's called The Bleeder. It's about Chuck Wepner, who's actually the person that really inspired Rocky. He's a boxer that was sort of a, you know, a ham and egg boxer.
Yeah.
He fought Muhammad Ali. He knocked Muhammad Ali down. He almost went the full distance. Essentially, that was what his career was defined by until the actual movie Rocky came out.
Uh-huh.
And when the actual movie Rocky came out and Stallone was talking about being inspired by Chuck Wepner, it essentially drove the real Rocky, the real Chuck Wepner, crazy because he was like, that's my fucking life. And it's a great script. Liev is fucking awesome and great story.
Is he still alive, Wepner?
He's still alive.
So and he must be feeling good about it.
Yeah, man. And he's literally like the real Rocky. Like his, you know, like his whole life. And it, you know, like the way that movie affected him, the success of Rocky and him being like, wait a minute, that's fucking me. And then no one's sort of, they're like, you know, the Academy Awards. He's like, well, I won. And they're like, you didn't win shit. Rocky won.
Yeah.
And it affected this guy.
Well, did Sly ever reach out to
him? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sly reached out and there was stuff. I don't want to say too much or say too little.
It's in the movie?
Well, it's in the movie. Not that I'm giving away things, but there was legality things.
Right.
But it's all stuff that's it's public. You know, it's out there. Like,
yeah.
They came to a settlement because when you look at it, like it was, he talked about it. You know, when Stallone did Rocky, he didn't know it was going to be Rocky. It was a $1 million movie.
Yeah.
It was like a fucking independent movie starring a guy named Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
Who was not Sylvester Stallone at the time. But, you know, that was one of the things.
Right.
I'm going to star in my movie. Like, we're going to get James Caan or fucking Paul Newman. And he's like, no, that's the way we're going to make the movie. So that's a great story. But that movie, seeing that and hearing this guy talk about, well, I was inspired by Chuck Wepner fighting Muhammad Ali, it drove the real guy crazy in a
way. Right,
right. So this movie's about that part of his life. And it's a good, you know, it's
that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's good. It's
good.
Who
directed it?
This guy named Philippe Fardieu, he's a Montreal Canadian.
Yeah.
He's a French Canadian. He's a Montreal Canadian. But so I'm not pronouncing his last name good, but he did a few movies and he's good and it's good pedigree of people.
Oh, great. So you're working, man. You're always working.
I can't complain, man. I'm knock on wood. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Thanks for talking to me, buddy.
Yo, I appreciate it, Mark. And you know, like it's a privilege. And I'm going to take this chair put this fucking thing on eBay.
No.
Is that cool?
No,
okay.
No.
All right. Fuck it.
All right.
Yeah, all right cool.
Maybe I'll give you, I'll find something. You can have.
All right. Well, if there's a guy, they should frisk me because I've been pocketing shit the whole time. Like I'm thinking, like maybe Obama touched this, maybe Obama touched that for the first
I could
ever.
Give you anything? Be like, yeah, this is
right.
Yeah, touch this piece of paper.
This bag here, this Target bag.
He wore that
spit
on his
into
head.
That.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, that's it. That was invigorating. Talking to Michael Rappaport is invigorating. I like him. That was fun. Go to WTFpod.com. A lot of posters going out lately. I like the posters. Maybe you will too. Get hooked up with some justcoffee.coop. Get the WTF blend. Get on the mailing list. Go there. Go. Guitar? Why not?
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.